This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to the show. Three quick things before we get started tonight. A, this was supposed to be an interview with Laird Scranton about his latest book. Great book, by the way. That will be next week. It may be a two-part interview, but my car broke down on the way driving home, so I wasn't able to make the interview. We had to reschedule. So instead, we are doing a Fringe News episode, which we were going to do anyway. I was just going to put it up on the site probably right after we did it. Instead, it's going to be our main show for WVBR and Dark Matter this week. If you like the show and you're only listening to it on Dark Matter or WVBR, remember there are a ton more shows available on wheredidtheroadgo.com. Thing two, I would like to thank all our patrons who stuck it out through Patreon's stupid fee change thing, which they have since gone back on and apologized. Very few people left our Patreon, and I appreciate that support immensely. Thank you so much. For those of you who, those few of you who did leave over the changes, they have decided not to make those changes wisely. They have listened to their audience, their creators, and their Patreons, and they have apologized and went back on that. So kudos to them for correcting their mistake. And thing three, once again, I have to apologize for the audio quality of this interview. I decided to give the Zoom software another shot. I know some other people use it, and it works quite well for them. And I've used it, and it's worked well for one-on-one interviews, but it seems with the roundtables, the sound quality just suffers for some reason. And you will see that, or more exactly, hear that in this interview. It's not awful, but it's not as good as it should be. So I'm done using them until they improve their services in some way. I was just hoping to get something I would be able to edit a little easier, since they held the promise of having separate tracks for everyone on the interview, thus allowing me to go and take background noise out or boost or lower people after the fact, but it doesn't work. So, again, my apologies for that. It's totally listenable. It's just not as quite as good a quality as it should be. But, yeah, other than that, on with the show. And for Patreons, we did record an AMA show with this group of this roundtable for this Fringe News, and I will be putting that up in a couple of days. Meanwhile, here we go. All right, welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? I had apparently jinxed myself by saying this show was going to have Laird Scranton on, and it was going to have Laird Scranton on. I finished his absolutely amazing book, which is just literally mind-boggling in how interesting it is. And my car broke down on the way home, and I missed the interview. So, I suppose if you like cars with antifreeze sprayed all over the engine, I got the car for you. But otherwise, yeah, there's no Laird Scranton this week. I reschedule for him for next week. And so hopefully nothing like that will happen again next week. So instead, what was going to be the Fringe News show is now also, you know, our main show for this week. And I am joined by Mr. Adam Sane.
Hello.
Joshua Cutchin.
With the promise of staying awake this time.
No snoring.
Melissa Martell.
Hey, guys.
And Ren Collier.
Hey, everyone.
And we're going to discuss a few things going on in the paranormal fringe sort of world today. But the first thing that kind of affects everyone is the whole net neutrality thing. And this is, you know, the thing about the net neutrality thing is that this comes up almost every year, it seems like, where someone is trying to eliminate net neutrality. The only people it really benefits, of course, are the big companies like Verizon and stuff, who can then basically throttle your traffic so you get stuff easier than, you know, the stuff they don't want you to see, essentially. Most big companies like Amazon, Netflix, and things like that are against net neutrality because it's potentially going to hurt them. They may be charged more to use the bandwidth, and then, you know, they're going to end up charging all their users more to cover the charges for, you know, them being charged more. Realistically, I think the best idea is for Congress to pass a law that sticks the net neutrality there. It'll be harder for it to be overturned, and it's not going to come up for, you know, a revote every year or two, because it was inevitable. Eventually, someone was going to get it passed, and that's what happened this past week.
Yeah, you definitely can't forget that the chairman of the FCC right now, Ajit Pai, is a former board of directors for Verizon.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yep. You have a huge interest there in getting this kind of legislation passed. And a lot of people talk about how, oh, well, they're going to charge you specific amounts for using, say, like Twitter or Facebook or that sort of thing. I honestly don't think that'll happen. I think the more important thing for people to remember is that this is sort of a blank check for ISPs and telecom providers to decide what you can easily see on the internet and what you can't easily see, and pricing that structure into how much they charge other companies, effectively blackmailing them into paying like whatever they want them to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you saw, like, Netflix traffic for streaming movies makes up something like 60% or more of internet traffic at this point.
Yeah.
Even beating out porn sites. So, you know, that's, they've been bitching about that for a while, saying, hey, you know, Netflix is using too much bandwidth. We want to be able to charge them more. Well, now they have that option.
And for me, like, I'm in Canada, but it could spread. Like, it's happening in the US, so it could spread to other countries. Like, it doesn't mean that it won't happen in Canada. And I'm concerned about how it affects small businesses and people who are thriving on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, will they continue to thrive? That's serious. That's some people's lives are like in threatened. And you know, the connection between me and Americans and people in the UK it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the people who was one of the Republicans who voted against it, against keeping net neutrality, was saying that the internet's not really a important resource. People don't need it. People don't rely on it, so on and so forth. And it's like, what world do you live in? I mean, yeah, we don't need it to survive, but for the way our culture goes today,
it's a series of tubes.
Yeah. For the state our culture is in today, we do rely on it.
Oh. I mean, if that was the case, like maybe we wouldn't be able to all do this show, or yeah, everyone might not be able to show up and have our discussions. And it might not be like food or water or air, but it's a part of, you know, something that creates part of a subculture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the internet should have been regulated as a public utility a long time ago, just like electricity or water or gas. And unfortunately, telecom lobbyists have prevented that from happening for decades now.
Yeah.
You know, I in general, in the broad strokes, think it's, you know, it's really going to be an important defining moment in the political landscape going forward. And I think that it's a pretty much a garbage move, coupled with some other stuff that's happened lately. But I happen to wonder if on some level, if there's some sort of net effect of people using the internet for necessities, if that might not have some sort of positive effect on society in general. Mm. If people maybe think a little bit more about how they're spending their time, or they're spending their time offline a little bit more in meat space, especially among younger generations, that might be, you know, some sort of residual benefit to this. Like, again, I think that overall it's going to be a very detrimental thing. But, I happen to wonder if maybe there might be some ancillary benefit to it, just in terms of getting us to be a little bit more present.
Yeah. On the flip side of that, a lot of marginalized young kids only have outreaches over the internet. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of like queer youth. Sometimes they might live in a small town where there's literally no one else like them. And like the internet can really be the only reason like they haven't committed suicide yet.
Yeah.
So in that case, like, I mean, that's the other side of it. For some people, yeah, it really is life or death.
And I also have a friend who is severely disabled, and she is blind and house ridden. but she is able to talk to everyone and participate in everything because of the internet, something that, you know, 20 years ago, she would have been alone that whole time.
Yeah. I mean, think of education and how we use it. I mean, as a designer, as a graphic designer, even in the schools and the colleges and, you know, things people can get for free. Like when I was learning code, there's so much free stuff that they give you to help you out as a poor student and access to, you know, instant information that, you know, before we would have been in libraries, it would have been so much more difficult and it's so much more easier. And you have access to so many different tools. It's just like to pay for each one of them is insane.
Yeah. Well, what Portugal did is Portugal apparently has packages. Like you could get the Netflix, Amazon package and pay a little more for that.
Right.
Kind of like TV stations, you know, when you get a TV deal and you get these stations at, you know, it would be those stations at full bandwidth or these stations at full bandwidth.
Well, that was a little misleading, that thing I saw on Twitter, because that was actually for a Portuguese cell phone ISP. Like that only applied to like cell phone data packages. It's still very dubious, and like I mean all data should just be the same. It shouldn't be segregated like that.
Yeah.
But it was for a mobile phone company. Not a lot of people made that distinction.
Do you think it'll be more like I have to, like, Canada has very different, like, way more expensive mobility than the United States, so I have to pay like lots of money for, you know, I'm always turning my data off because I have to pay quite a bit of money for what I get. Will they turn the internet into something that's where you pay for, like, almost like it's mobility?
In some places, it's already like that. I know anybody who's on, or most people who are on Comcast nowadays actually have a data cap. It's fairly large. I think it's like 300 gigs, but I mean, people who stream games or people who do a lot of streaming tend to run over that cap. I know I did when I was in Atlanta, when just from using like a VPN from my office to my house. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that sort of pricing structure all exists. I mean, I think the era of sort of unlimited data on the internet, even for your home connections, is probably going to be coming to an end.
I don't know about that, because I don't know of any internet companies other than, well, yeah, all the ones around here pretty much have unlimited data unless you're going through the phone company, like, you know, through Verizon or saying where you're using their data, or even like HughesNet, which does give you a cap where it slows you down, but only during the day, during peak hours.
Wasn't HughesNet satellite anyway?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's why. I mean, it's not like you're not getting that much bandwidth to begin with.
Well, but actually, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's just, it has a big lag on it is what the problem is.
I think it's funny, like, there's a lot of fear of the unknown because we have no idea what this means. We just only know the internet as it is now. And I'm reading that a lot of states and representatives, I mean, there's a lot of lawsuits that are going to be waged against the FCC.
Yes.
Well, so it's not over yet.
I mean, one of the big problems too is they've maintained and allowed these monopolies to occur through, you know, not regulating anything because of lobbyist influence. So in a lot of places, you know, if you're lucky, and it's sometimes in like rural areas, there will be, you know, other ISPs you can use. But in a lot of major cities, you kind of only have one or two choices at most. And one thing I'd like to see is more cities doing publicly owned options, like in Chattanooga, Tennessee, they have their own private fiber network ISP that, you know, if you're a citizen of Chattanooga, you can get it, and it's extremely cheap and it's very fast. That's a lot of things people don't realize. Like the United States and I guess North America too, I don't know if Canada's like this, but internet speeds here are some of the slowest in the world, and they're also some of the most expensive. If you go to places like, especially in Asian countries, like in Korea and Japan, they have extremely fast internet connections for, you know, for a fraction of what we pay here.
Yeah.
Bandwidth costs fractions of a penny. I mean, I've worked for ISPs. I kind of know this from the inside. They are very resistant to having to spend money on their own infrastructure, if at all possible.
Yes.
They tend to run it until the doors fall off. And they don't like investing. They basically, instead of investing in their own network and expanding it, increasing speeds, they just charge people more.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. I know Canada definitely does not have one of the fastest connections at all. I was reading, I can't remember the report, but there was like countries considered less progressive than ours that have way faster internet than Canada. So they're definitely far from being the fastest.
It's just price fixed because they're monopolies. I mean, it's just, it's all an illusion.
How do you think this is going to affect like podcasting?
Good question.
Because this is not, like, I mean, the net neutrality stuff, I'll be honest, I really, that's why I haven't said anything. I'm really not knowledgeable enough about it to really have an opinion. In other words, like, I know that some people say it's bad and some people say it's good. That's about all I really know.
The only people who say it's good are the people who stand to profit from it.
Yeah.
Which are the big mobile companies like Verizon, AT&T, and people like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think would happen to the future of podcasting?
I think if you're putting out podcasts through like a major provider like Apple or like these big companies, you'll probably be fine. It'll be just like normal. That's what I think a lot of people won't even notice it if it really goes through, because they use the same websites every day. These major websites like Amazon, eBay, Netflix, they're all going to be fine because they have the money to cough up. The big thing is going to be people who use lesser known services, use lesser known sites. And the net effect of that is it consolidates what we experience as the internet into just a distinct number of like websites for these major corporations. It's sort of like if people remember the early days of like AOL, like early AOL, you didn't go to the internet. You went to a central intranet that AOL completely controlled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what the internet's going to turn into.
The mail, you know, that you used as a coaster. And
so basically they're going back in time a little bit. They're kind of regressing. Yeah. Oh, boy.
And it all depends on what they do. Because here's the other thing. Yeah, it's going to be harder for startups and stuff to make an impact because they won't have the bandwidth. But potentially you could have an ISP that'll say, hey, we're not doing the net new, you know, we're going to keep the net neutrality rules in our company. So if you go with us, you know, no throttled bandwidth, no pay for sites, and everyone will flock to that.
Yeah, but how will people get service through them? Because the infrastructure and like the fiber and all the main stuff is really owned by three companies in the United States.
True.
They're going after Bitcoin next, Ren. That's a Ponzi scheme.
Oh my God, I heard Ajit Pai say something about high volume Bitcoin mining, and I was like, bro, you have no idea what you're talking about. You're just saying words. You're just saying buzzwords.
I was referencing the guy that hung up on you the other night.
Oh God. I felt so bad about that. Made that guy so angry.
Maybe he's easy to trigger. It's hard to say.
All right. So let's move on to some more paranormal themed stuff. Let's look at this one on the Warrens that's been published. This came out in the Hollywood Reporter. And this is not totally new in a sense that there has been a lawsuit ongoing over The Conjuring. And but there is some new stuff that has turned up. Now, I've been saying for pretty much the first thing I ever saw from the Warrens, I had picked up a book, oddly, from the Science Fiction Book Club back in like the 80s. And it was one of the only paranormal books they had. And I said, oh, cool, a book on ghosts. I don't remember which one it was from them. And I read it, and I was like, wow, this was complete crap. And then I would see them on TV shows, and I'd just think, you guys are full of crap. And, you know, then eventually when internet and stuff and their names started popping up a little more, I did more research and came away with, yeah, that was the right feeling. I mean, these people were basically charlatans. And The Conjuring 2 just pissed me off to no end because, A, they weren't even involved in the case, and, B, it made them out to be saints, you know? Mm. I mean, they were made out to be this great, wonderful people, and because the whole thing is turning to be about these movies is turning to be about them. And I was just like, okay, they were the ones going in telling the lead investigator, hey, I know how we can make money off of this. And in the movie, they're portrayed as the ones who helped the family and all this other stuff, which just wasn't even remotely true.
Yeah, was that Guy Lion Playfair that said that about them? That
yes.
They came to him and said, Ed came to him and said, hey, we're going to show you how to make money off of this. And he said, no, go away.
Right, right.
That was the extent of their involvement in the Enfield case.
No, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, there have been other people who have come forth, and also there was some couple who were having problems, and it turned out not to be paranormal. And Ed told them, well, just keep your mouth shut and you can make money from this.
Mm. There was also apparently one where he said, oh, I'm sorry, Melissa, I totally stopped.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
There was also another one where he said something to the author of the book of the Haunting in Connecticut. in a dark place or whatever it was called. I think that's the title of it. He actually, the author came to him and said, what do I do with all these differing accounts that this family is telling me? How do I make this into a story? And Ed apparently said to this guy, well, the family's crazy. Just do the best that you can.
Yeah.
That so makes sense too. Yeah. When I was younger, I picked up a used book in a bookshop from them. I can't remember if it was The Demonologist or I can't remember which one it was, but I remember reading, you know, and they're saying he's possessed by a demon. And I remember reading it going, this guy isn't possessed. This guy is an abusive husband. What the hell? Like, I remember actually thinking that, and I was 16.
So, devil made me do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, in terms of sort of the way that they're lionized in the Conjuring series, I mean, this is nothing new for marginal figures. I mean, heck, we have a movie coming out soon about P.T. Barnum, where P.T. Barnum is starring, is being played by Hugh Jackman as some sort of, from what I can tell, heroic character. I don't think it's going to be very nuanced in any sort of way. So,
yeah, as a, it's just a heroic character as opposed to a guy who owned a literal human zoo.
Yeah, exactly.
What actually does the article say? Like, it's like pretty scandalous. Like, it's
okay,
intense.
Do you care if I describe some of it?
Go ahead.
Basically, when it comes down to it, so there's this lawsuit that's going on, as Soraya said, with some of the way that they are being portrayed. I think someone that wrote one of the books about, I think, the first Conjuring case has sued, or one of the script writers. It's hard for me to remember exactly what it was, but the new revelation has come out through the course of this civil court case, is that there's this woman, her name is Penny, apparently she's now in her 70s, and she apparently had a relationship with Ed Warren from the time that she was 15 years old.
Woo-hoo.
And she lived in the Warren's home with the complete knowledge of Lorraine Warren. She acquiesced in this, I guess. So she lived down the hall. They also said that the way it's portrayed as them having a daughter in the film, is it true that the daughter actually went and lived with a grandmother, and that the young girl that lived in the house is actually this woman, Penny? And they also said that she actually helped Ed fake evidence when she put on a white sheet and walked through a graveyard. So it's some scandalous stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead. No, Ed's having this big illicit affair with a minor.
Right. Yeah. With the
and
knowledge
then faking
of
evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. This is the stuff that has come out. And of course, like, there's people that are saying, well, she's being coerced to say this, or
like are hashtag people, me too kind of thing.
Well, no, I think this came out in like 2014. That this came out. So this has not had anything to do with what has been going on now.
It's kind of funny that.
But I think the testimony she gave was in 2014, but I think this is just now all kind of coming out about.
Yeah. Okay.
Because of these ongoing lawsuits that they are not depicting the Warrens as they say that they are, or they were. I'm conflicted a little bit because I really think, you know, I think the word charlatan may be a little too harsh for one part of them, because I think Ed was. I think he was kind of the showman. Like, he didn't care. He was kind of the pragmatic, you know, I'm going to do this to make money, put on a show for people. But Lorraine, I think, was and still is a true believer. I think she really believes this stuff.
Like, but I mean, legally, that's a pretty serious thing. But I mean, movie-wise, does it matter if it's like, I mean, people are going to see a movie. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I don't necessarily agree with them or like them. But like, does it really matter if you're going to see a movie? Like, you know, it's a movie, right? Like, you know, it's not real. Like, you're expecting.
Yeah, I think the problem is that it says that it's based on a true story,
which means nothing.
But I think there are some people that have a problem with of saying that this is truth when it actually isn't.
And I had a friend who knows how I feel about the Warrens, and he kind of goes to me, I liked The Conjuring 2. And I'm like, what? What do you mean you liked The Conjuring 2? He's like, I don't care about the Warrens. He's like, I just watched it as a movie, and I liked it. And I said, okay, fair enough, you know? Yeah. And I think that's how most people are.
I just, you know, I like real good solid research, and I you know, I'm just so dismayed by them, and I have a lot of UK friends that absolutely can't stand them, but I just wanted to play a little bit, like, does it really matter when it comes to fiction?
And are the Conjuring films doing any more damage than Ancient Aliens or any of the tripe that's on TV? Really, no. And from an objective standpoint, not being invested in this, they work. You know, if you don't care about that aspect of the story, they work. Something that I would point out that I think that, I mean, yes, you have the marginal aspects of them as researchers and the problematic aspects of forging, basically falsifying, you know, evidence. But this is the point where I would point out, similar to what I'm sure Jeff Ritzman would say if he were here, that, you know, this sort of thing is attracted to marginal characters who are sort of on the fringes of what's considered acceptable and, you know, sort of decent society. We can't ignore the fact that some of the stuff that they ran into might have had some sort of basis. I mean, it could be anywhere between 0 and 100%, but I think that it's the old thing with every poltergeist case, right? Like, there's a legitimate phenomenon, and then as time goes on, it becomes more and more apparent that aspects of it have been faked. And I kind of wonder if that's just not part and parcel of what we're dealing with here. So it's just, you know, a little, again, devil's advocate, like Melissa was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it doesn't mean that the phenomenon isn't real. It just throws everything in doubt, what you get from the Warrens.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like, you know, it's...
And remember, they were also involved with the Amityville case.
Yep. Well, to me, I view the Warrens' work as sort of as like I view Phil and Brogno's work. I mean, there was this whole big kerfuffle where Phil and Brogno's credentials were revealed to not be true. But when he was writing stuff, he was writing stuff with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. And I know Rosemary is enough of a stand-up researcher that to not throw away those joint combined works. But at the same time, I have to sort of view them with a grain of salt. So, you know, I think the problem is that people need to just be really discerning and really continue to be skeptical about stuff that they read. And that sort of level of skepticism should elevate when they see something from the Warrens.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, so how much does their personal life, like, I mean, I'm not promoting that he was with someone who was a minor. I think that's apprehensible. And
promoting sex slavery, is that what you're saying?
No, not at all. I think it's horrible. And I think it's terrible. And you know, it really does. I mean, to be Lorraine and to have a wife who promotes that, it's like he has to be some kind of intuitive person who knows who is easy to, you know, who to get with, who's easy to give him what he wants and manipulate things. And so he seems to be, you know, I think you do have to be a little bit critical of him in that way, because he seems to be fairly manipulative. So he has a wife who's,
of course,
who's complacent and all this stuff. So it does depict how he's approaching life and other things in a way. But then you're like, okay, where's the line drawn? Like, where does it get separated? Unfortunately, I wrote an article about the Amityville Horror, and they weren't the people who, like, the Lutzes actually didn't pick them specifically. They were brought in by somebody else who the Lutzes, you know, it was like a chain reaction. So, but they sort of contaminate things by their own personal issues, kind of thing.
Yeah, they also bring in their own, they bring in their own religious viewpoints too, which I think also, like you say, contaminates it as well and turns it into something that it could actually not be. I'll say this about the matter, that when, you know, you're caught, when if there's a statement now that Ed faked at least one bit of evidence, in my mind, that could throw out everything else. No matter how true it could be, you kind of have to throw it all out. I mean, we look at what, you know, Peter Robbins had to do with Left at East Gate.
Just
a couple of things that he found that Larry Warren lied about, he threw out the entire book.
Yeah, I mean, there's
an integrity issue, I think, with this too.
You know, as a researcher, like, I just finished an essay for an upcoming collection, and there are some points where I would have, some instances where I would have loved to have used Amityville stuff, and I would have loved to have used some of the Warren stuff, but I didn't include it. I think there's an obligation on the research side, but on the consumer side, as long as you're informed of this, go ahead and, you know, read away.
Right.
But, you know, or even as a researcher, you know, say that, you know, bring in some caveats about, well, this isn't, you know, this is certainly not an unimpeachable source, you know, buyer beware, but here is this sort of correlation or something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, I actually just found the book I read from them. It was Ghost Hunters, True Stories from the World's Most Famous Demonologists. And it came out in October of 1989. And I wish I still had my copy because the used ones are going for $50.
Ew.
New ones are going for $126.
Wow.
I would wonder how John Zaffis would feel about some of this stuff, whether anybody's ever gotten him to talk about this, because he's, you know, he's Ed's nephew.
Right. I knew the name. I couldn't remember how he related.
Was he involved in any investigations?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, he was. Involved?
I don't know.
I think he was involved with stuff in the 80s. He definitely was involved with the haunting in Connecticut stuff. Which, you know, again, I think that there were, like, Amityville Horror, Haunting in Connecticut, I think real things happened, but once you pulled the religion into it, things got weird.
Yes.
But here's the other thing. They went in with the idea that this is a demon. That's, I mean, that was their thing.
Yeah.
And it could have, you know, in the one case where he told the people to be quiet and they can make money off of it, it turned out to be literally a psychological issue, you know. Mm-hmm. They had a mental illness that they were dealing with, and that's what all the stuff was. But they told them to be quiet, not acknowledge that, and treat it like it was a demon, and they can make money off of it. But when you're going in looking for demons first rather than more practical explanations, that takes you down the wrong road, and that is dangerous.
I think you're accountable. Like, I think people, like, if you're going in as a professional and you're going to help somebody and they have a mental health issue, I mean, you're accountable for that because you're leading that person down to a worse path.
Yeah, you sure are.
Yeah, there's no debate about that. You're accountable.
There was, I don't know if any of you have watched the new series of The Exorcist.
I haven't seen any of it.
No, go ahead.
It's actually really good. It's probably going to get canceled. It's not doing very well because I don't think many people are watching it, but it's actually very well done. And in the second season, one of them starts being convinced that, you know, this woman is, or this girl is possessed. And the other exorcist is going, you know, to stand down on this. And he's going, no, I've checked all the signs, you know, because as we talked about, Adam, when we did the show on the one exorcist there, they have like certain signs they look for, and they're using those signs.
We did the show about Malachi Martin.
Yeah.
Part of the round table. Yeah.
And so he's going, no. And it turns out that the woman was faking it. Like, not the woman, the girl who was possessed, but the mother, in order to get attention. And the other guy noticed that things just didn't quite add up. And that's, you know, yeah, that's fiction. But that's kind of what happens when you go in with that mindset that you're looking for certain things, when you're looking for demons, when you're looking for the paranormal, and you're not looking at what else could be going on here. It can take you down a bad path, you know. In the show, they get the little girl away from the mother because they realize she's basically abusing her. She's burning her with bleach, telling her it's holy water, and things like that.
Well, have you guys seen the movie? But it's actually a documentary. Have you seen Belief? Have you guys watched that on Netflix?
No.
No.
What's it about?
That's it's about this family in New Zealand that are Maori. And they believe that this woman starts to show, one of their family members starts to show signs of mental illness. Well, they're told by this, one of their shamans, that this is a, whether, you know, they're priests or whatever, that this is a water spirit. And so they take her, they all take her to this one house, and they do this, they're doing this, it's like a group exorcism where the entire family is involved. And it eventually ends up killing her, just because her body just gives out, because they're just dousing her with water and she essentially drowns. And everyone just gets worked up. Mass hysteria comes in. And you got to watch that. I mean, it's just the power of belief is so strong that it just becomes this kind of vicious feedback loop. And in that case, somebody died. which it was a real story. This really happened, I think, in like 2005 in New Zealand, which is that, you know, we didn't get the story here, but it's also similar to like the Annalise Michel in Germany in the 70s, the one that The Exorcism of Emily Rose is based off of.
Yeah.
I mean, the speculation was that she was mentally ill, but like the priests were partly responsible for her death.
Yeah, like she probably had epilepsy.
Yeah. Yeah. But her own belief influenced it too.
Yeah, exactly. I know Exorcism, we did a show with the Curious 14 a while ago, and it's on the rise. And I mean, like, there's like a shortage of priests or something, like that's really interesting. And I know at the time of like Amityville Horror and things like that, where the Warrens were involved, this was a big hype. The Exorcist was released in 73. There was a big hype about this. So it's not just about stories. It's about what's in the media. And this was the thing. Like, there's The Omen. Like, how many movies are on about this kind of thing? So
all that also contributed to the satanic panic of the 80s.
Exactly.
All those occult movies in the 70s and all this kind of stuff all contributed to all that, you know, don't listen to your metal albums. That's why Soraya's so evil now.
Yeah. And I guess now, I mean, like, with the case, what we're talking about now in this article about the Warrens is, I mean, she's, like, frail and old, and, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. They're obviously, they're suing the studio?
Yeah.
Is that what they're suing the studio? So, I mean, they're not actually suing Lorraine Warren. I mean, she's, like, 90-something.
Yeah, she's up there.
She's pretty up there.
Yeah, she's quite frail, and I don't think she's in the best of health.
No, I don't think so. And it wasn't Lorraine that I think, you know, like you said, Lorraine seemed to be the better of the two, but she did let this stuff happen. There's no way she didn't know.
You know, like, people think, like, oh, it's the person who's doing all the bad stuff is, like, the evil one. But, I mean, she's the other side. And some
she's the enabler.
The enabler can play passive, but they're just as cooperative in the whole function of it all. Because she could have just walked out and said, no, this guy's crazy. But she didn't. Right. But well, now again, she's belief, too old.
belief played in there too, and she is 90.
Yeah, exactly. Now she's too old. I mean, you can't really. There's not really much to do.
All right. So the next thing we wanted to talk about, Adam found, and this will go beyond this article here, but it's from the Evening Standard in the UK. Man bursts into flames and dies in front of horrified onlookers while walking down London street. Specialist fire investigators found no obvious reason why John Nolan, 70, might have caught a light. And that's basically sums it up. He was walking down the road and he suddenly burst into flames and it consumed him and he died. And when they said when they checked him, there was no obvious reason for him to catch fire. There was nothing that should have triggered it. There was nothing on his body that should have caused a fire. And the witnesses, no one can explain, you know, anything. He just literally burst into flames and died.
So since SHC, spontaneous human combustion, is a sort of a pocket interest that I have, I'd like to point out that this particular case doesn't really share a lot of the hallmarks that you see in traditional SHC cases. Usually you have someone who is morbidly obese, who has a penchant for alcohol, and is typically smoking at the time that they are dead. Spontaneous human combustion is one of those weird 14 things that's almost proven in the sense that there's a lot of very, very, very strong evidence for this actually happening. But generally what people will find is like a hand or a foot or something in a charred sort of pile in the house. Typically it happens in like an armchair or a bed. The primary theory is that there's something called the wicking effect, which is this idea that somehow either through the cigar that someone has, or through some other unknown means, the actual flame ignites the fat in the person, which keeps them burning for a long time, which actually generates them, basically allows them to become a pile of ash, or, you know, sort of a residual stain, as opposed to an actual, like, burned corpse.
Yeah, it kind of acts like a wick, right?
I'm not sure if I buy that one.
Well, I think it makes sense. I mean, they literally become a candle. Like, that's the idea. Like, their clothing acts, excuse me, their clothing absorbs the melting fat. Like, they probably set themselves on fire through some material means, right? And then their clothing soaks up this melting fat, and then it acts as a wick. But it kind of creates essentially a human fat candle that doesn't, like, explode into flames or really burn that much around it. Because, I mean, your candle doesn't really burn anything around it, but it burns it all the way down to, like, nothing because it burns very hot. I mean, I can buy that.
Can you title this show Human Fat Candle?
That was my nickname in high school.
It doesn't exactly explain cases like this, though, where people in broad daylight just, like, burst into flames for no reason. Like, that makes a lot less sense to me. Like Josh mentioned, some people, okay, they're in bed, they're smoking. You know, there's probably more mundane explanations, but these spontaneous kind of in public ones, I don't know what I think about that.
And there's also been spontaneous cases where someone, like, went out to get cigarettes for their parent or whatever, and they came back 20 minutes later to find a pile of ash. Mm-hmm. In those cases, the wick effect doesn't work.
I'll take a little bit of an umbrage to what you said, Ron, because I think that even in explainable cases, it's still not mundane. I mean, it's a pretty remarkable thing. Sorry.
Micah on the Grailian Report a few years ago had somebody on who had a theory of what was actually happening, and it was way more believable than the wick effect because it took place quicker and it had to do with a chemical reaction in the body that involved things like alcohol and being morbidly obese and so on and so forth. But I don't remember the guy's name or the show. I mean, it was...
I think I got your name because I have him right here. I think was it Brian J. Ford?
It might have been.
Because he has this thing about acetone getting created in acetone-rich fat.
Yes. Yeah,
like, they spontaneously combust. And it literally, you YouTube him. He has experiments. He's from the United Kingdom. And you YouTube him and he has experience where they do this and it lights up just like spontaneous human combustion. And it has something to do with something that happens in the liver and stuff where it does this process where acetone gets created in the fat. And usually people are, like you said, obese, they have, or they smoke, or they're alcoholics. Everyone has something in common where they're not very healthy and they create this acetone-rich fat in their body and then it goes boom at some point and spontaneously combusts and burns rapidly.
And that I find to be probably the more likely explanation as to what's happening. I mean, combined possibly with some cases of the wick effect and possibly some other stuff. I mean, like this case obviously doesn't fit those criteria, but, you know, there could be another explanation for what happened to him.
Yeah, it's important to remember.
It still could, though.
Yeah, it's also important to remember the wick effect, too, isn't the cause of the combustion. It's rather
why it
something
keeps going.
That happens that keeps the combustion going or causes the physical after effects where, you know, somebody's just completely melted down to just like a foot or something.
Now, when I did the show on Kundalini, I've mentioned before my Kundalini has gotten so hot sometimes that I feel like I'm going to burst into flames. I had a number of people write me who had Kundalini experiences where they actually had flames, where they caught flames poking out of their fingertips and things like that. So that is also a possible thing. Assuming those people were accurate in what they were describing. I mean, I know I've felt that way where I've been like, oh my God, I feel like I'm literally going to light on fire any moment.
But just walking down the street.
Oh yeah. It can happen anywhere. Yeah, with Kundalini, it can happen anywhere. If it kicks in, it kicks in. It doesn't care what you're doing.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and it's such a powerful energy that it overwhelms you very, very quickly. So there have honestly been times where I'm going, maybe I need to, like, go somewhere really cool right now so I don't burst into flames.
Wow, it's like a hot flash.
Super hot flash.
If you find something about a greasy spot on a couch in Georgia, you know what happened to me.
All right.
Joshua Cutchin burst into flames today. Gotta get that book out first, Josh. Don't burst into flames.
I know. Actually, I've had thoughts with my books. Like every time I get to this stage where I am with this one, I'm like, what if there's a Carrington event and I don't get my book published? And I'm like, if there's a Carrington event, I have bigger problems than getting my book published.
Oh. You know, Melissa contributed this article to the Where Did the Road Go about this woman who's done having sex with men after having sex with ghosts.
Oh, good Lord. I didn't think this was going to come up. Crazy.
We just talked about that we went into depth on that on Conspiranormal. Yeah.
Wait, did you say goats?
Ghosts.
No. Ghosts. Oh, ghosts. Okay.
Yeah, somebody just stood
ghosts,
there.
Ghosts, not goats. Yes, somebody was saying something about goats in the comments, and you're like, ghosts, not goats.
Oh, okay.
It's just taking that scene in Ghostbusters to its logical conclusion, okay?
Oh, the Dan Aykroyd scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Busting makes me feel good.
Exactly. Especially when it's with a ghost.
And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So this has obviously been sensationalized massively. But because wasn't it on some talk show?
Yeah.
And, but you know, you do have the incubus and succubus encounters throughout time.
Right.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not actually a ghost she's having sex with. It's a tulpa that she made, right?
Well, she says it's a ghost, but it could be a tulpa.
Because I thought like the experiment was that her and her boyfriend were like trying to create a tulpa.
No.
And then they created a tulpa, and then she started having sex with it and sort of like stopped having sex with her boyfriend.
That's not what I read.
No. Oh.
Well, apparently there's multiple women doing this now.
There's probably
there's all these.
Well, I think the article, if it's the same article that we used, I think from The Guardian or Broadly or whatever, I think that it talks about two different women. And the one woman that was on the morning talk show in England, her name was like Amethyst Realm or something.
That's
like that.
That's the one I posted about.
That's a tulpa creating name.
Huh? Yeah. But she says it just happened. And like she went home and she started having sex with the ghost. And her boyfriend came home and saw the figure of the man with her and promptly left. And it's just weird.
I should have never Googled sexual tulpa, but this is leading me down a rabbit hole.
I hate to say this, but I just seen something on my feed in Facebook that now says something about her wanting to have a baby.
Yeah.
Ghost.
Yeah.
Did you guys see that one? Yeah.
It's
actually progressing.
Which actually that led us into a discussion of your book, Josh.
Oh, geez. Well, yeah, that's actually something I was going to say is that, like, we're all living in glass houses throwing stones here. I mean, we talk all the time about, you know, sort of reproductive phenomena among all sorts of, you know, entities and whatnot. And it's part of, honestly, to be fair, it's part of a rich tradition. I mean, you look at, for example, some South American tribes and their beliefs surrounding river dolphins. They believe that the Boto pink river dolphins actually come ashore at night and in the form of, you know, beautiful men and impregnate women as well. So it's
right.
On the face of it, yes, it's goofy. And do I think she's full of it? Yes, I do. But it's also not... It's not the craziest thing I've heard. I mean, I wrote about a guy getting pancakes from Space Italians, so it's...
Right.
All in perspective.
Yeah, I mean, looking at some of these experiences that people are having sex with tulpas and spirits and stuff, I'm just, like, taking it in contrast to my experience I had the other night where I think a spirit or a ghost tried to have sex with me, and then I ate it. I know, I told some people about that, but yeah.
Are you hoping you're a praying mantis deep down?
I don't know. I think I was very offended. I told some people about it, but I had an out-of-body experience in which right as I started to exit, I felt something crawl into bed with me and like put its arm around me, and it had like a female voice, and it was like, no, no, stay with me, stay in bed or whatever. And I got out of bed and it jumped on my back and I started wrestling with it. And when I threw it off my back, whatever landed on the bed looked like, I don't know, like an octopus or something. It was just like,
now this is a dream.
It seemed like an out of body experience.
Okay.
Yeah. And cause there was like a continuity, like I went out of body and then this happened. And I got really mad and started eating it because I was angry that it had jumped on my back and had tried to mess with me like that.
I mean, psychologically, we'd say that's like a really good, I don't want to say metaphor, but it's a really good analogy for, you know, dealing with something and confronting with something that's trying to consume you.
Yeah, it certainly had, I don't know, metaphorical resonance within like things I'm going through in my personal life right now. So.
That's interesting.
So your first response was then to eat it.
Yeah, it certainly got rid of it.
Well, maybe the devouring.
Maybe it was I don't know, a peek inside what I really want in my life, I guess. Not animalism, but you know, more in a metaphorical sense.
I'm speechless right now.
I would be like totally interested to see like a Jungian analysis on that. That would be fascinating.
Well, I was supposed to at some point next year go on Nox Mente, so maybe I'll talk to them about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed my conversation on Nox Mente.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I liked your show.
I got to go on there the other night. It was like really last minute, but it was interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah, like Josh mentions, the whole people having intercourse with the spirits is something that goes back really far.
Yeah. Yeah, because we haven't posted the show yet, but we talked about Lilith.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep.
Some of the interesting things with her and what all that meant and how there's a root there too. And then of course, you know, you have the Nephilim that you know that's described in the Bible and
it's a fixed
thing.
It's interesting. So I'll share a little. A little synchronicity that I haven't with anybody, and not trying to turn this into the show about me and my
ahead.
But I think that people don't necessarily understand the sort of possible impact sort of Lilith has on a lot of these things, especially the child abduction angle, because she was, of course, a demon, possibly of, you know, Mesopotamian origin that stole children. In some traditions, I believe circa 900 AD was reinterpreted as Adam's first wife, appears as a large black cat in some traditions, which has obvious 14 connotations. In Iceland, possibly was the mother of all the elves, which has some 14 connotations as well, you know, in terms of, you know, child abduction among the faithful. But my own personal synchronicity was I was playing a Great Gatsby party. So in like a 1920s, 1930s themed party at a historic venue here. And they had, for whatever reason, they had a tarot reader. I went and got my tarot read, and I asked her for her contact information. She didn't have a card. So she pulled out a card from another deck. I can't remember what the deck was, but it was just sort of a deck of like spiritual beings. And this is in the middle of me writing my current book on paranormal child abduction, which is very Lilith, mentions Lilith quite a few times. And the depiction on the back, she wrote her information on the back of the card, and on the front, it was actually a depiction of Lilith. So that's my big synchronicity for this current line of research.
what was interesting, I was doing some research on this, looking at the whole succubus and the incubus stuff, and this is something I got off of Wikipedia, but it talked about that basically how would a ghost make her pregnant? So I was looking into that, and there was this belief that the succubus would come and get the sperm from the men, give it to the incubus, and the incubus would give it some kind of power, of which then the incubus could then impregnate the women, and then the woman would have a malformed child. And it seemed like in the Malleus, it was like the Malleus Maleficarium, that they describe, it described in that, that was the process that would happen. So it seemed like it was this way to kind of explain deformities in a way.
Yes.
But that also really fits in with the changeling stuff from fairy lore too.
Something in my notes that I brought up to Josh was that the more and more I think about at least material explanations of sort of the changeling mythology, just thinking about social conditions at the time, especially like, you know, the common women really didn't have access to abortion or birth control. And people knew how many children that they could support. So in some cases, I wonder if changeling mythology became a way for people to unshoulder guilt that came from infanticide, because you're able to say, well, it's not really human and it's not really my child, so it's okay to just kind of leave it outdoors until it dies. And that way it's not like a crime, really. You're able to unburden yourself of that.
Yeah.
And it's very dark to think about it that way.
It's insightful, though. I think there's something to that.
Yeah, I think that's
also... Lilith was also used as a threat to children, to say, if you're not good, Lilith is going to come get you, and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, excellent points all around. I can't wait to get this freaking book published.
All right, I'm going to go to another one that Melissa shared.
Oh, I shared another one.
You shared a bunch of stuff in the last couple of weeks.
I do that every once in a while. I have to have a place to put it.
And this one is how the god you worship influences the ghosts you see.
Ah, yes.
And this came out of Neuroscience News. And basically it's saying that some people, that people who are true believers, who are very religious, tend not to see ghosts, and people who are atheists tend not to see ghosts, but people in the middle are more prone to seeing ghosts. And there may be other reasons for that than the actual belief system.
Well, I do think it's interesting that a lot of, I wouldn't say necessarily sightings, but I would say whatever it is that you're watching does influence, like, I would think superstition and a lot of old world beliefs, I don't have the stats for this, but they're probably down in numbers. Like, people probably don't believe a lot of things like that. But there's also now probably people that post orb pictures like crazy, and they believe that.
Yes.
You know, because they're influenced by that. Maybe not by religion, but they're certainly influenced by that, by the television and the media they watch. Maybe it's their religion. I don't know. So there is some sort of influencing factor,
but I think, though, like, they're talking about, I forgot where it was now, but they said, you know, like I said, true believers tend not to see as many ghosts, and people who don't believe in anything don't tend to see many ghosts. But I'm wondering if, you know, when people see something unusual, I think that there are some people, A, who don't notice.
Yeah.
And B, people who will just block it out. Like, they just acknowledge, even if they see it, because it bothers them. So
I've had that as an experience. So, you know, a few friends of us, we went to an old pub in Victoria, Canada, and two of us had this really strange experience, you know, up in the bathroom, and we didn't want to go back up there. And the third one was, like, adamantly no, and staunch and very scientific, and said no, absolutely not. So I definitely that we had a more open perception about what could be. But I mean, we literally were up in a bathroom where we felt like, when we were leaving, we felt somebody walking behind us and, like, tapping our shoulder. And then the other person was like, nope, never felt anything, nothing, there's nothing here, there's nothing. And the other two of us were, you know, so we're adamant that something very strange was going on, but we were more open.
And I think there's people too who just don't have the sense, you know, they're paranormal blind, just like someone's colorblind. They don't pick up those things. Whatchamacallit, who's the big atheist there that Graham Hancock confronted about this whole thing? I had it right on the tip of my tongue a moment ago.
Not Dawkins.
Yeah, Dawkins.
He's talking,
Dawkins had said he had, you know, Graham asked him if he would try ayahuasca, and he said, well, I would try it, but whatever happened, I would just, you know, put down to the miracle of the brain or whatever. But he also said he had tried the God helmet and was hoping to have some odd experiences and nothing happened. And I thought, is that because you don't believe anything's going to happen, or is it because your hardware just doesn't pick this stuff up?
Well, I think, I mean, the beginning statement, these people who experience these kind of things are not either, they're not true believers and they're not true skeptics. I mean, I think Dawkins is so far on that binary that he would not experience something. I mean, you think about a lot of the figures that create religious movements like Joseph Smith. I mean, he wasn't a super devout guy. He didn't follow any particular religion. He practiced religious folk magic. And that's, you know, kind of in this middle space is where he, you know, met the angel who provided him with the golden tablets and all that. Same with Muhammad and the founding of Islam. I mean, it's these people are sort of in between those two sides of the coin. And when they have these sort of experiences and they change people and they're changed themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Jeff Rinsman talks about all the time, you know, sort of the liminal space that these people live in is rife for these type of activities to occur to them.
I mean, and let's also address the presupposition that Dawkins had would have that, oh, it's the miracle of the brain. Well,
right.
Words mean something. And saying it's the miracle of the brain is to me no different than saying that there's something legitimately supernatural going on. And I know that people sort of mince words over between like the meaning of supernatural versus something that is natural but not discovered. But I think if you could sit both folks down, they would really sort of be angling towards the same thing. So yeah. I think blind faith in the miracle that in I believe it's called the empty promissory note of science, that somehow there will always be an explanation for something that we can't explain, I think is problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the fact, you know, if you want to take it scientifically, you don't go in with a presupposition that this is what you're going to decide it is no matter what happens. That's not a scientific way of viewing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, granted, it's not, you know, the problem with something like ayahuasca is it's very hard to confirm what you're experiencing is not just inside your head, but you can't assume that either.
Yeah, I mean, you can explain the visual effects by saying, oh, it's affecting these, you know, visual neurons, and it's doing this and that on a material level, but then how do you explain the contact with seemingly intelligent external entities during these experiences? Like, how do you explain being given prophetic knowledge, like, after taking some kind of plant or fungus? Like, there are things that happen within those spaces that can't simply be explained away by, oh, it's just, this is how it's, like, affecting your brain chemistry.
And it could be the brain interpreting information in a different way and pulling information that we normally wouldn't have access to that doesn't require external entities, but we have no way of knowing which one of these things is what's going on.
Yeah. But it's more than just, I guess what I'm saying is I think we know that it's more than just, oh, well, you're seeing patterns because it's affected your visual cortex or whatever.
Right.
And I think that there might be some point to the fact that a lot of these things take place in an unobjective perceptive space. I think there might be some point to that. You're not meant to be believed or believed. You're not meant to have your experience validated. One size doesn't fit all. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah. No problem.
All right. Well, I saw, Melissa, that you also posted in the Where the Road Grow Brook. Wow, let me try and talk again.
Where did the road go?
that the Folklore podcast had covered the story of Jeff, the talking mongoose, which is one of our...
I've just spent, actually, I do an e-zine, like a magazine for that, and Mark is so busy, we still haven't got the transcript out. But I did all the, I've started all the design for it. So that's what I've been doing all day. But yeah, it's Jeff the Talking Mongoose on the Folklore podcast today. And that's like a Harry Price big article. And He interviewed Christopher Jessoff. He's got a book out called Jeff, The Strange Tale of an Extra Special Talking Mongoose. I'm not totally like, I've listened to the podcasts, and I advise obviously everybody to do that because I am the art director for it. and it's interesting. I've done the design around like a newspaper headline kind of thing because it was big news in the 30s, I guess. And Harry Price investigated this case of a talking mongoose, and it was supposed to be some sort of intelligent being of some sort, but in the form of a mongoose. I'm not, you know.
Yeah, it's a weird, very singular story. There's not really any other ones out there that were quite like this one.
Yeah.
He was the eighth wonder of the world.
wasn't there that Charles Fort story about the talking cat as well?
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, that's but that wasn't like that wasn't a talking cat in residence like Jeff was. And the other thing about Jeff is that like Jeff was seen as, if memory serves, sort of like sometimes as a sort of a ferret, and sometimes as sort of a cat, and maybe even sometimes as sort of a dog. Is that right, Melissa? Or
I'm sorry, what was that?
So Jeff wasn't always seen, like, sometimes he was seen as, like, a mongoose, but sometimes, like, he was seen as sort of a cat, and sometimes as sort of a dog. Like, he sort of had a shapeshiftery kind of quality to him.
Yeah, like I say, like, I don't know the whole scope of it. I just know that there was this family, and it started out with the mother and the daughter, and then the father took it on, and it became like this, like, it became like this sort of phenom where it was this mongoose talking. And like, I have a quote on, I've done the design, and I did design like a newspaper article, like, hey, here, you know, like, and everything. And it's like, if you knew, and the talking mongoose, one of those quotes where if you knew what I know, you'd know a hell of a lot. But like even the name Jeff, like G-E-F, it's supposed to be like Jeff, like G-E-O-F-F, and it's spelled wrong. I'm not sure like what happened, and there was some spelling mistake or something like that. But I'm not totally, I have a feeling something really strange is going on there with the family dynamics, but I mean, that's just my opinion.
Well, I mean, so some of the evidence that you'll find in the Jeff case, they picked up some physical evidence in the form of some footprints and stuff, and that was always sort of downplayed and sort of discredited. But this is where I, okay,
go ahead.
This is where I come in to go into traditional Josh territory. It's difficult to look at the Jeff case, and obviously it's reported often as a poltergeist case, but it's difficult to look at that and not see the traditional role of a sort of household spirit in the sort of fairy folklore sort of sense, because Jeff would do things like extinguish the stove and, you know, provide, he was sort of attached almost like a sort of a personal familiar to this particular family in this particular house. So it also has that, especially, again, it was the Isle of, was it the Isle of Skye or was it the Isle of Man? Isle of Man, I believe.
Yeah.
And so like that sort of part of the world has that sort of tradition as well. So it's interesting that I don't think anybody has really dug into Jeff as sort of this traditional house spirit, but there are a lot of similarities there.
Well, I think like the our guest, if like I have really quickly listened to this podcast, and he's gone on you know, with his book to really, really detail this in general. And I mean, Christopher Jessoff has access to Harry Price's, like the archives of Harry Price's. So I want to get hold of the book, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He's from the UK, and he has access to those archives, and he's a librarian, and just phenomenal, like, yeah, stuff that we don't actually have access to. So I think I would like to read dimension. The book.
I have the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah.
He also said something about splitting the atom.
I thought Andre the Giant was the eighth wonder of the world.
Remember, kids, Jeff the Mongoose says, you won't need eyes to see where we're going.
That sounds so cliche.
let's hit a couple of these other ones real quick. There is where can people find the Folklore Podcast, by the way?
At www.thefolklorepodcast.com.
All right. So does anyone here think there's anything even remotely legit about the frozen Bigfoot head?
Generally speaking, if there's anything involving physical evidence that isn't a track or scat or hair, I generally ignore it about Bigfoot. So, no.
I just want to hear it scream.
Again, this entire show has been full of great metal band names. Frozen Bigfoot Head. human Fat Candle, yeah.
There's that guy, and then there's also the interstellar object, which is interesting. Now they decided to just take a look and see if they can pick up any kind of technology with it.
Oumuamua,
yeah, something like that. Yeah. But the thing about it is, we always assume that if someone is going to use technology, it's going to be just like ours.
Yeah, it's true. And I kind of love the idea that it was an alien spacecraft. And as they went by, they just went, shh, nope, shh. Just kept on going.
Well, it could have been using, this is just a theory, right? But if, say, it is a spacecraft, it could have been using the sun as just a slingshot, just to keep momentum going, using the gravity well. But on the other hand, too, I kind of like the idea that people are maybe looking at that because
there are
some constants in the fact, like, if you're going to build a spaceship, right, the easiest way to do it would be just to use, like, an asteroid or something. Like, why would you haul raw materials off planet and build a spaceship? Like, why wouldn't you just use something that's already out there? Like, turn a small moon or something into a spaceship or turn a small asteroid into one, because it's already, all you got to do is carve it out, make caves in it and stuff and hook some thrusters to the outside, and there you go.
Well, isn't our moon a spaceship?
Well, exactly.
There is that book, Our Spaceship Moon.
Yeah.
Oh, and what is it? David Icke thinks it's a alien. It's a space station as well.
Does he?
Conspiracy theory.
Now, guys, let's back off a little bit, because there's some weird stuff about the moon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We don't have enough
time left in this podcast to talk about.
Another podcast or two or three.
Yeah. As part of my personal mythology that I only sort of ironically believe in, I sort of see the moon as an artificial satellite.
So do I.
Like, I don't know how hard in the paint I go with that idea, but it's very appealing to me on some level. So yes. I tend to go with that.
Absolutely. All right. So let's go around the table here. Adam, where can people find you?
www.conspiranormal.com and conspiranormal.podomatic.com if you want to access the archives.
All right. Josh.
JoshuaCutchin.com and here at Where Did the Road Go. I actually put up a blog for the first time in 7 months, so go look at my blog.
Is it about Star Wars?
No, it's not about Star Wars. It's about the Ibu Gogo.
No? Melissa?
I just have a site that I've just put up that I'm developing. It's scarletart.rocks, and that's Scarlet with 2 T's. And you can find me on Facebook as Melissa Martel or Scarlet Art. And I have a graphic design site that's mdmcreate.weebly.com.
All right. And Ren?
Hey, so you can find my writings at liminalroom.com. Should have something up soon about some of the out-of-body experiences I've been having lately. And I can also be found on Twitter as at Mr_APOL, like Mr. spelled out, MISTER_APOL, APOL.
Okay. And real quick, Josh?
Yes.
What's your opinion of the new Star Wars movie?
It's, I was someone who was highly critical of The Force Awakens. I thought it had great character work, and I thought that the plot line was embarrassing in its own way, sort of being a little bit of a rehash and sort of having some, I'm not a big person who complains about plot holes, but there are some plot holes in there. And the new one has satisfied me on every single level. There are about 8 or 9 moments in there that I could not believe made it into a Star Wars film. Even if you're not a Star Wars geek, just some really interesting creative decisions. And it's It might even be tied for my favorite Star Wars film.
Nice.
So, wow.
This comes as a form. This comes as a form as a charter member of Wikipedia. So,
Star Wars geek here, and me and my son are going to see it tomorrow night.
just be prepared. Just be prepared to see some stuff that you aren't expecting to see in a Star Wars film.
Will blow us away. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
And Josh, I'm gonna give you this. You need to go listen to the podcast called Mabel. It is a fictional Mabel. Podcast. It is done the storytelling way they tell the story initially is through a series of phone messages, which sounds like it wouldn't be interesting, but it is, and it is knee deep in fairy lore.
Mabel or Mable?
Mabel.
Okay.
And it is incredibly well done. It gets to the point where it's almost like listening to a piece of art. But it is literally just couched in fairy lore, especially as it gets going.
I'm finally gonna dive into the fictional paranormal podcast rep with you, Soraya. So I'll do that.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
And a special thanks to our Patreons who are pledging at the $10 or above level. Roland Belstedt, Alfred Tuttle, Carla Mahoney, and Gabriel Zero. Thank you very much. All right, to take you out tonight, we're going to hear from a band called Dreadnecks. And I actually had these guys play my music show, The Last Exit for the Lost, last week, and they really just blew me away. They're a very entertaining live band. And it's spelled Dreednecks, Dreadnecks. And they're very fun. They play everything from metal shows to folk festivals, and they're very quirky. So this is a song from them called Human Parasite. If you like it, check out more stuff from them. They're really good guys. And eventually there will be a video on the Last Exit page of them performing live in studio, and they're kind of goofs when they play. It was a lot of fun. So see you next time. have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.